In October of last year, Tucker Carlson commented on his talk show, "Rich people vote liberal. I don't know what that's all about." Well, judging from Andrew Gelman's new book, Red State, Blue State, Rich State, Poor State, Why Americans Vote the Way They Do, that Tucker Carlson was kind of right. Mr. Gelman examines the reasons behind that distribution of red and blue on state election maps and why we may be putting too much faith in them. His book is published by Princeton University Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Dr. Gelman to the show today. Hello.
Hello. Pleasure to be here.
Now, some people will be surprised that Tucker Carlson was even partially right about anything. What did he get right on that?
Well, he looked at the map of red and blue states, and he saw what a lot of people have seen, that Democrats are winning the richer states in the West Coast and the Northeast, and Republicans are winning the poorer states in the South. And it seems a little weird. Why should, you know, why is that?
Because Republicans have always been thought of as the party of the wealthy. Why have Democrats performed better in some of the wealthier sections of the country then?
Well, the simplest explanation, the obvious one, would be rich people are voting for Democrats now. And that's what Tucker appeared to think. But actually, that's not true at all. Rich people vote more Republican, and the gap in voting Republican between rich and poor is as large in the past few elections as it's ever been.
So the poor are not voting for economically conservative candidates, as Thomas Frank would have us believe?
If poor people were a state, they vote like Massachusetts. And if rich people were a state, they vote like Texas.
So, because so if that were the case, why doesn't the 51% with less income raise taxes on the upper 49% at will?
Well, not all those 51% are economically liberal. The correlation between your social class and your economic attitudes is not that high. It's there, but it's certainly not 100%.
You say, although this contributes to what you describe as the red-blue paradox.
Right. So the paradox is you look at the map and you see the Democrats are winning in the rich states, the Republicans in the poor states, but yet the Republicans are winning the rich voters. So how could that be? And it doesn't seem right. The simplest explanation is it doesn't work. Maybe it's social issues, but that's not quite right either, because actually in America, richer people are more liberal on social issues but still vote more Republican. And so the voting patterns at the individual and the state level still seem contradictory, and you have to go inside each state to understand what's going on.
You include a fair number of maps in this book, and things change a lot on those maps. For example, in 1976, the presidential election, California was red, Mississippi was blue. Not the case anymore. In fact, the map looks – the only thing that remains constant – in the two maps is that the center of the country is solidly red.
Yeah, things have changed a lot, and that's one reason I give journalists a lot of credit for making a big deal about this. And
the you give red them blade, credit for it?
For I give the red state, the idea that the red-blue battle, the idea of red America versus blue America, the Northeast and the West Coast being where the liberals are, that's new. It is news. So it's very appropriate that after the 2000 election, a lot of fuss was made about this, because this was a gradual pattern that's been building up for decades.
This book grows out of an article, as I understand it, that you wrote, which included What's the Matter with Connecticut in its title. Now, Connecticut is a state with the highest average income in the United States, but it also has pockets of extreme poverty, New Haven, for example. So how does that reflect it in its voting patterns?
Well, Connecticut, unlike the country as a whole, in Connecticut there's no correlation between your income and how you vote. In the last couple of elections, the Republicans got about 45% of the vote in every income category in Connecticut. So it's just flatlining. And that's unusual.
I mean, poor people voted 45% for the Republicans and rich people did.
Yeah. Everybody was voting 45% Republicans.
But did that add up to enough to give them a Republican governor and a former Democrat as a senator?
Well, at the presidential level I'm talking about. So, yeah, they do have a Republican governor, and voting for governor is going to be different because both parties in a more liberal state will run more to the left for governor, or more in a conservative state the other way. But yeah, the richer people in Connecticut and other states such as New York and California have a bit of a conflict. They're on average, they're on the economically conservative side. They're well off. They're doing fine. But socially, they're very liberal. And so neither party is quite doing it for them. And as a result, they're voting pretty much the way poor people in their state vote.
Do you think that Connecticut might have supported John McCain if Joe Lieberman had been his choice as a running mate?
There's a lot of talk about vice presidential candidates. From historical data, our best estimate is it's worth about 3% of the vote in the vice presidential candidate's home state.
Well, Al Gore didn't take Tennessee when he ran for president.
Al Gore did not take Tennessee. Maybe he did a little better in Tennessee than a non-Tennessean would have done. But that's right. It's just a little bit. It's the number one reason for picking your vice presidential candidate has to be this is a person you think is going to be a good president if something happens to you.
So that's what's happened here with Joe Biden and Sarah Palin?
I have no idea why they were chosen, but if I were a candidate, I mean, put it this way, any candidate has to balance going for tactical concerns and aiming for what they really want. Otherwise, they wouldn't be running for president at all if they didn't have any ultimate goals. Vice president might be a good place to think about your ultimate goals because you're not going to get huge tactical gains from it, at least looking empirically.
Getting back to the rich state, poor state, how would you define a rich state and a poor state?
We use median family income, so we're not – you could argue that everybody in America is pretty rich compared to how people were 100 years ago or in other countries, but just relative to each other.
So Alaska, for example, has a higher than average median income. I think it's 15th in richest in the country. So that would make it a rich state?
Well, Alaska is if it is 15th, then it is one of the richer states. We do some of our analysis breaking up the states into thirds. So we take the one third of the population in the richer states, the third in middle income states, and the third in poorer states. And most of the poor states are, I mean, I can't remember about Alaska, but pretty much they align where you might think they are. The poorer states include Mississippi, Louisiana, West Virginia. The richer states include New York, California, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey.
And you write that in rich states, wealthy people were more likely than poor people to vote Republican, but only by half as much as rich people in poor states. So rich people in Mississippi are much more likely to vote Republican than they are in Connecticut or New York or California.
That's right. Rich Mississippians are a very strong Republican. They're voting Republican well over 70%.
So how do we explain that?
Well, one way to do this is to reframe it and say that the red-blue divide is occurring among rich voters, not among poor voters. So if I look at the map of who would have won if only rich people had been voting for president, who would have won, it turns out that only a few Kerry would have only won a few states, like New York, California, and a couple of others. If we look at how poor people vote, it's just a patchwork quilt. It doesn't look like much at all. So there's a big discussion about a red-blue culture war, and I think it's real. I think the journalists who have talked about red America versus blue America are onto something, but it's really isolated among the upper half of the income distribution.
My guest is Andrew Gelman, whose book, Red State, Blue State, Rich State, Poor State, Why Americans Vote the Way They Do, is published by Princeton University Press. Can you describe journalist Steve Saylor's theory about why rich coastal states have more Democrats and how that affects family formation?
Well, so Steve Saylor is a movie reviewer for Pat Buchanan's magazine, and he has an interesting theory that, well, he starts off from looking at states like New York and Los Angeles and Chicago and saying they're bounded by water, so they can't grow very fast. Because they can't grow very fast, property prices go up, because property prices are so high, it's very hard to live there if you have a family. And so the people who end up living in these places are more likely to be singles or people with small families or maybe people like myself who started a family when we were a little bit older. And those groups of people are more likely to be socially liberal than people who have a lot of kids when they're younger, who are more likely to be socially conservative, end up moving to maybe places in the middle of the country like Phoenix, where there's more space and cheaper land.
And Americans do move quite often. According to census data, 48% of Americans moved between 1995 and 2000. So that affects voting patterns, because the ones who are more likely to be conservative are more likely to move to the Midwest?
Well, it's where you move and also where you stay. And, of course, the Midwest is roughly a 50-50 region. Most of the people who move don't move far. And the higher income people are more likely to move further. And so one conjecture that we have, although it's hard to get the data on it exactly, is that nowadays richer people are more likely to be able to move where they want for cultural reasons. And richer liberals are more likely to end up in New York or San Francisco or maybe Austin, Texas. A richer conservative, you know, might not go to one of these places.
And Republicans tend to move more than Democrats for some reason. Is it because the poor Democrats can't afford to move?
Higher income people are more likely to move greater distances. Lower income people are more likely to move locally, which is, you know, just a different phenomenon, going from one apartment to another.
And if you are rich, you're likely to move to where you're going to find people who share your values. So if you're a liberal, you're going to move to New York or Los Angeles or San Francisco, et cetera. If you are more conservative, you're going to move to some place where people will share your social and economic values as well, and that might be in the Midwest.
I think that's part of it, and it's also economics. Yeah.
Because where businesses are located are important?
Well, getting back to Connecticut, the financial services industry is huge in Connecticut, and that's an industry that favors the Democrats.
Uh-huh. Delaware is right now the center for most credit card companies, but they tend to be rather liberal there.
Right. Well, there's a lot of that. There are a lot of geographic variation in what industries are important. Yeah.
Hedge fund managers tend to live in New York. Should we assume that they're more likely to vote for the Democrats?
Compared to other New Yorkers, hedge funders are pretty Republican. Compared to other people who make that kind of money, hedge funders are very Democratic.
My guest is Andrew Gelman. He's a professor of statistics and political science at Columbia University. He's written a number of books, including Teaching Statistics, A Bag of Tricks. And his most recent is Red State, Blue State, Rich State, Poor State, Why Americans Vote the Way They Do. It's published by Princeton University Press. Stay with us for more. We're back with Professor Andrew Gelman of Columbia. He's written a book called Red State, Blue State, Rich State, Poor State, Why Americans Vote the Way They Do, published by Princeton University Press. And you include a 1972 quote, misattributed, you say, to the film critic Pauline Kael. She was supposed to have said, or somebody did, "I can't believe Nixon won. I don't know anyone who voted for him." But whether she said it or not, you say that that quote demonstrates availability bias.
That's right. Well, first let me give you some background. We had that quote in the article version of the earlier precursor to this book, our article, and I put it on our blog, and then I got a response from somebody who was a guy who just is a big fan of Pauline Kael, and said how she didn't say it, and he got really angry at me for saying this, and he had a lot of evidence that she hadn't. So let me start with that. People make fun of Pauline Kael for saying that, even though she didn't. Of course, nobody in 1972 was going to say they can't believe Nixon was going to win, because they could see the polls, and it was in the news all the time. So that wouldn't be a surprise. The availability bias I want to talk about is the kind of reason that people like Tucker Carlson, that journalists who know a lot can make mistakes. I have another quote for you from Michael Barone, who's one of the most knowledgeable political journalists in the country. He's the editor of the Almanac of American Politics. He's been doing that for 35 years. He wrote, "It evidently irritates many liberals to point out that their party does not run very well among the common people." Well, that's just not true.
But Michael Barone is also a political conservative. So he could have said the same thing in a more in a less partisan way and perhaps gotten away with it, don't you think?
I don't think that anybody liberal or conservative who makes their living as an expert gets anything out of saying something wrong. And I think what happens is as follows. The Michael Barones and Tucker Carlsons of the world, they're doing well. They have friends who are well off. Most of their friends are, or many of their friends are politically liberal. So they have a mental map, and it goes like this. In one corner of the map, you have rich liberals. Then, you know, on average, people are in the middle, and so they're extrapolating to the other corner of the map. And they're saying, well, there must be a lot of poor conservatives to balance the rich liberals. Now, the mistake they make is that in New York and California and Maryland and some other places where elite journalists live, there's not much of a connection between how you your income and how you vote. If you go to Oklahoma or Texas, you'll find a very strong correlation between income and how you vote. And so the availability bias that Michael Barone and Tucker Carlson make is really a more subtle mistake that we all make it at some point, which is that we generalize about correlations in our vicinity. No one's going to make the mistake that Pauline Kael was supposed to have made. That's just silly. But a more subtle mistake is possible.
We also get conventional wisdom because of availability bias. All of those people go to the same parties in Washington and in New York, and they all hear each other express opinions, and then you hear them all say the same thing on the Sunday morning television shows.
Well, yesterday's counterintuitiveness is today's conventional wisdom. And our project started, really, when read an article by David Brooks in the Atlantic Monthly about red America versus blue America. He wrote that after the 2000 election, and he looked at that map and said, whoa, what's going on? How can the Democrats, who are supposed to be the party of the people, winning in the rich parts of the country? And he drove around and compared a rich area where people eat a lot of sun-dried tomatoes and to a poor place where nearby where people eat meatloaf platters, and he noticed something that was important, which were these geographical divisions. He didn't realize that these divisions are concentrated among the rich, but that's okay. You have to sort of start somewhere. But again, that became the conventional wisdom at that point.
Well, David Brooks also hangs out with a lot of Republicans who share his opinions. He was the only person who thought Barack Obama's speech yesterday wasn't good, and then he came up with what I thought. Whatever you think of Barack Obama's speech yesterday, I thought David Brooks's article today was one of the lamest parodies I've read on the op-ed page in the New York Times for quite a while, at least since Maureen Dowd's last parody. You have, forgive me for editorializing here, you have a chapter called The United States in Comparative Perspective. How are voting patterns in the United States different from those around the world then?
Well, this is a funny thing. I was sort of brought up to believe as a student that Europe was class-based society and had class-based politics. America was a middle-of-the-road country where it was Tweedledum versus Tweedledee, which is either good or bad depending on how you look at it.
In other words, the workers in Europe tended to vote communist or at least leftist, and intellectuals would also vote that way, and then everybody else was split up.
Yeah, in Europe, they have these things called labor parties and things like that. It seems like a more class-based society. Conversely, we think of America as being a society where people vote based on religion, and religion seems like something that they haven't worried about in most of Europe much since 1648 or so. But then when we looked at the data, it turns out that rich and poor differ in how they vote in America much more than in 80% of the countries around the world we looked at. So American voting is really more class-based, more income-based than in almost all of Europe.
How does it compare to countries that have a political spectrum rather than two or three dominant parties, countries like Italy or Israel?
We looked at the left and right groupings. So we didn't, for every country, we just counted whether you voted for the generalized left or the generalized right. But we also found that religion matters in how you vote in America, and I'll get back to that if I have a chance. But it matters just as much in a lot of European countries.
Well, it wouldn't. Well, European countries are assumed now to be so secular that it wouldn't be of a concern. And you spend a lot of, pay a lot of attention to Mexico, where everybody's a Catholic, almost, and most of them are fairly religious.
Yeah, well, it depends a lot. It depends a lot on the country, but the in several of the European countries, such as Germany, the religious regular church attenders are much more conservative in how they vote than the non-attenders. And so it's not just the U.S. where religion is a dividing point.
In Mexico, doesn't it pretty much divide that along class lines? The rich tend to vote for the conservatives, the PAN or whatever, and the poor for now for this new party that is of the far left?
Yeah, in Mexico is actually a lot like the U.S., that there are regions, there's a conservative region of the country in the north and a more liberal voting region or left-wing voting region in the south. But then within any state, the rich people are more likely to vote conservative.
So we have this country that's ideologically split. How does one party build a majority coalition? Last night, it was apparent that Barack Obama was thinking about just that in his acceptance speech, in which he tried to suggest that we can all find areas.
And their motivation is going to always be to choose the focus on the issues where the other party is at the extreme and they're more centrist.
What role does a president play in bridging the gap between the states and the different, the competing ideas of what a Republican and Democrat are in the
as
different
far as
states?
What people think of
can
the
a president
of
either party be a uniter,
be
not
pain,
a divider, as George W. Bush promised he'd be?
Well, in the survey, 50% of the people thought Bush was a uniter and 50% thought he was a divider.
I
think that
somebody's math was off.
The president plays a role partly because it's the same candidate who everyone's voting for. And so as you can be in Connecticut and vote, be a liberal and vote for a Republican governor, but at the presidential level, you're voting for the same candidate as everybody all around the country.
Yesterday, we talked about changes that are occurring in the West with states that were solidly Republican now all have Democratic governors, and some of them are likely to vote for the Democrat in this upcoming election. And one of the reasons given was changing demographics. People were moving into the area. So are the people who used to move to California and New York now moving into Montana and Colorado, New Mexico?
I don't know the answer to that one. But the smaller states, of course, would require fewer people to change things.
Do you think that sometimes we pay too much attention to the maps that we've been talking about?
I think the maps can be misleading. You see big states like Montana look big on the map, but they don't represent a lot of people.
In fact, you have several maps in the book that show the breakdown in distorted ways by population. The United States has a very different shape then.
Yeah, there's bulges where most of the people are. But I think the real thing is that you get a lot of discussion about poor people voting for God, guns, and gays, the idea that religion and social issues are the opiate of the masses. But the evidence is that that's not the case. The evidence is more the opposite, that as people become richer, they more likely to have the luxury to vote based on social issues. Religion predicts how you vote. Religious attendance predicts how you vote much more if you're rich than if you're poor. And richer states, income is less important in predicting your vote.
So when you say rich, are we talking rich or are we talking middle class?
Upper middle class. I'm talking about that maybe the top 25% of voters. There is some evidence on the richest. a political scientist named Tom Ferguson went and looked up political donations of the Forbes 400 and Fortune 500 executives and looked who they contributed to. So there's a little data on the super rich, but that's mostly not what I'm talking about.
Andrew Gelman is professor of statistics and political science at Columbia University. His latest book, Red State, Blue State, Rich State, Poor State, Why Americans Vote the Way They Do, is published by Princeton University Press. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It was a pleasure.